Welcome to Health Center in the Catskills on WIOX Radio. I'm Diana Mason, the host of this program, where we focus on the impact of local, state, national, and global issues on the health of the individuals, families, and communities in the Catskill region. H.R. 1, the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill Act that Donald Trump signed into law a year ago, cuts Medicaid and the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, funding substantially and makes changes in the Affordable Care Act's insurance coverage such that it has been estimated that over 10 million people will become uninsured. In Delaware County in 2025, one of every five people was on Medicaid, and they are among the most vulnerable among us. But these cuts affect all of us, as hospitals and other healthcare organizations will lose revenues that they need to support offering to continue to be able to offer services that our communities need. This is such an issue in rural communities that some of these hospitals may close. In response to this concern, Congress created the Rural Health Transformation Program to bring money to health care in rural communities. New York recently issued a call for proposals for distribution of this funding throughout the rural areas of the state. Well, Dr. Leighton Koo is professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management and director of the Center for Health Policy Research at the Milken Institute School of Public Health at George Washington University, where I have an affiliation for transparency purposes here. And he and his colleagues conducted an analysis of what the impact of H.R. 1 on rural communities would be and whether this rural health transformation program would offset the losses from Medicaid and insurance coverage through the Affordable Care Act. The paper is titled, H.R. 1 Funding Cuts Will Overshadow Gains from the New Rural Health Transformation Program. And it was published on June 9th by the Commonwealth Fund. I want to welcome Dr. Leighton Koo back to Health Center in the Catskills. Thanks for coming back on, Leighton.
Thanks, Diana. Nice to be here.
Well, it's good to have you again. And for listeners who may not be clear about what Medicaid covers, just give us the quick take on what is Medicaid. People get confused between Medicaid and Medicare.
Sure. Medicaid is the federal state program that covers low-income mothers, children, families, seniors, people with disabilities, with health insurance. And that's by comparison to Medicare that is primarily aimed at senior citizens and some people with disabilities. Medicaid is a much larger program in terms of the number of people that it serves, though its costs end up being less than Medicare's.
And the Affordable Care Act was designed to actually included ways for states to expand their Medicaid coverage. Just say a word about that.
Sure. The Affordable Care Act, based back in 2010, was designed to be the first big effort to expand health insurance in a number of years. And for Medicaid, the principal goal was to expand insurance coverage for low-income adults up to around 133% of the poverty line so that they could get coverage. Before that, in most states, Medicaid eligibility levels were well below the poverty line. And it varies somewhat. For example, in my home state of Texas, Medicaid eligibility was and still is around 25% of the poverty line. New York was somewhat better off, but even New York was able to expand coverage a fair amount to help more people.
Yeah, so states had to opt in to extend some of the Medicaid benefits, and not every state did, but even some of the states who are considered red states and did not want to cooperate with some of the things in the Affordable Care Act, some of those states saw the benefits that there
are. The great majority of states, 40 states.
40 states.
Expanded Medicaid.
Yeah. So there's been a real advantage to states to do that. Now, talk then about how H.R. 1, or the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, affects Medicaid and coverage under the Affordable Care Act.
in general, a big goal of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act was to cut funding for health programs and other entitlement programs like SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, to cut those back and to cut back benefits for low-income people in large measure to pay for tax cuts for wealthier individuals. So that's sort of the big picture of what the bill did. More specifically, it cut back Medicaid in a number of ways, particularly aiming it at states that had expanded Medicaid coverage. So some of the most controversial provisions, things like we can talk later about work requirements under Medicaid, sort of penalize states that expanded Medicaid, don't do anything whatsoever to states that didn't expand Medicaid.
And so these cuts, we think about it. I mentioned that about one in every five persons in this county we're in is actually on Medicaid. And the I'm anticipating, and I've done other programs talking about how some people will lose their benefits, and some of it comes about because of greater bureaucracy that they're adding to being able to apply for Medicaid and staying on it, as well as the SNAP program, staying on the food supplemental food benefit program. So are there other ways that you're anticipating that H.R. 1, the cuts that are proposed in Medicaid, will roll out? What other strategies had Congress in mind or the administration as they implement this, the Medicaid cuts, how they will meet the financial goals that were set in the H.R. 1?
So there were lots of parts. It's a bill with many, many provisions. One of them, the most controversial provision as far as Medicaid goes, was the requirement that people who had expansion coverage had to demonstrate that they were either working 80 hours a week or doing some sort of community service or were in school. Otherwise, they would be disqualified. And that is expected in and of itself to end Medicaid coverage for around 5 million people. The theory that the proponents of the bill had was that, gee, why should people who are lazy and not working get Medicaid benefits? That instead, if we take sort of a tough love approach, that by requiring them to work, it's going to help them, and this is sort of an incentive. And so the government recently issued some interim regulations to implement this rule, and the government claimed, and this is a completely false claim I've written about this, that this was going to create millions of jobs and lift more people, millions of people out of poverty. Again, completely false. There's no evidence for this. This was basically people who were, they were smoking something when they wrote this stuff. But anyway, you know, it was happy talk from the administration. The reality of the matter is we know where this has been tried before, both in Medicaid and SNAP, that there are all these new paperwork requirements that mess up people in a couple of ways. One is that in some cases people can be exempted if they show that they're too sick to work. And obviously we realize that it's inherently the case. Lots of people on Medicaid are sick and have health conditions that render them unable to work. So the problem is that to demonstrate that can be complicated, and the new rules that the federal government put out made this even more complicated by saying that it's not enough that you have a condition that makes you sort of sick enough. You or somebody has to demonstrate that this person individually cannot work. And so the example I like to give is traditionally we would think of someone as blind, if you're blind, you probably can't work. The administration would sort of say something like, but wait a minute, Stevie Wonder is blind, and he can work, so why can't all blind people work? And so someone would have to demonstrate why they individually cannot work despite the fact that even though they're blind. And that's a very difficult burden, both for the patients as well as for the doctors, who might have to sort of write these things up. So it creates paperwork there. And then there's paperwork, and this is a brand new thing that the administration did, tried nowhere else. In addition to this, the paperwork involved in showing that someone has worked enough hours is also complicated. Mm-hmm. Think of how many people who work at the low-income scale are, you know, have part-time jobs working in restaurants or as Uber drivers or something like that. And so then it's not as though they will have a steady amount of work that they can demonstrate every single week. Mm. And so to keep track of all that is an insuperable barrier.
And the experience of states that have had a work requirement, like Georgia, I'm going to be interviewing somebody in the coming, sometime over the summer, about Georgia's experiment with work requirements. But we know that it actually is more costly to government as well to try to track this stuff and have enough people to process the information, the applications, and the confirmations that people will need. So
Georgia was the poster child for why this is a bad thing to do.
Yeah, yes. And so for people who are listening who are not on Medicaid, they may think, well, this doesn't affect me. Let's talk about why it does affect everyone. Talk about the impact of this on hospitals and other healthcare organizations.
Well, we've done some analyses of what are the economic impacts. So Medicaid brings in billions and billions of dollars in the states. And so, for example, we've done some estimates of how much money the state of New York, we think, will be losing money because of Medicaid cutbacks. So in a couple of years, we think that New York will lose $10 billion in federal funding. Wow. Now, that means that's $10 billion, and in many cases, then the state matching dollars might disappear, too, that won't go to hospitals, doctor's offices, pharmacies, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So this means that there's going to be have to be cutbacks in healthcare employment, and this has sort of repercussions that ripple through the whole economy. Our analyses suggest that, for example, in New York alone, in the year 2029, the Medicaid cutbacks could lead to around 51,000 jobs being lost, around half of them in healthcare. I don't know how many in the Catskills area, you know, something large too, but obviously the Catskills is a small part of the overall state.
Yeah.
But still, that's a massive loss across the country. We're estimating that in general, the Medicaid cuts alone would lead to the loss of 500,000 jobs. Mm-hmm. And so whereas, you know, sort of people who talk about work requirements say, this is going to create jobs. That's nonsense. We're going to be losing jobs. We're not creating jobs.
Yeah. And Leighton, in our community, there's always been concern that, you know, is our critical access hospital going to stay open? And while the hospital is owned by Westchester Medical, WMC Health, and they have given reassurance, we're not closing this hospital, you have to wonder about financially how much of a deficit a rural hospital can sustain before closure. And there have been lots of predictions about really high rates of closure of rural hospitals. So if the loss of jobs is not just, oh, we're laying off a few people, it could be the closure of a whole hospital, couldn't it?
Oh, exactly. I mean, the loss of jobs relates to the notion that there's money being taken out. And at a certain point, this leads to the extent to which a hospital basically falls further and further into the red. And at a certain point, basically faces bankruptcy and would have to close. I can't swear specifically for your hospital what the situation is like, but we do know that rural hospitals in many states all across the country have been closing in recent years, and this probably is going to sort of speed that up considerably. Now, I will say you mentioned the Rural Health Transformation Program. That was the effort that Congress had in large measure as a compromise that came from a couple of senators from Maine and Alaska who represent rural states who said, gee, we really want to do something to help rural states. So Congress created a small fund to help give back some money to rural health care, not explicitly to rural hospitals, but to improve rural health systems. This money has just been spread out for the first time this year. We don't exactly know how effective it's going to be, but the truth be known, the amount of money that's involved is too small to make a difference. So in the estimates that we have, when we look, even in this year, 2026, we do know how much money New York will be getting from the Rural Transformation Fund, but we also know how much it's going to be losing because of the loss of ACA market premiums. And the answer is, it's a big net loss. And in just a couple of years, when you add in the Medicaid cuts, this becomes much deeper. And that's why, in general, there are deep cuts that are taking federal funding away from the health economy of New York State, from rural areas in New York State. The Rural Health Transformation Fund might take the edge off a little, but don't expect it to sort of make the difference. In general, hospitals and doctor's offices and pharmacies in low-income and rural and underserved areas are going to face real threats.
And in fact, Leighton, in my read of this, and New York is participating in this program, and Margaretville Hospital, I know, will be going after some of those funds. But the funds cannot be to replace the actual revenue stream of patient care. They're supposed to go for innovations in care.
And that's right.
And so it's really asking hospitals and other healthcare organizations in rural areas to take on more responsibility or changing what they're doing, and then maybe that's good in a way that it will spur some innovation, particularly around telehealth. That could be very helpful. But if you can't get paid for the services that your patients need through Medicaid, you're still going to be out that money.
Right.
Yeah. So
That's the problem.
So you also talk about the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Where does this fit in to the picture of the cuts in HR 1?
So SNAP was also deeply cut along with Medicaid and the ACA Marketplace programs. SNAP is a small program that still serves more than 40 million Americans, so it's it's not a small program. But the amount of money is much less than the Medicaid budget. On the other hand, as a percent cut, the SNAP cuts are deeper. And one of the tricky parts of SNAP that I frankly think states don't quite know how they're going to deal with it, the federal government is saying for the first time, states, you may be on the hook for paying some large percentage of your SNAP cost. Historically, the SNAP program, the food benefits, were entirely federally funded. But in this case, the federal government is saying, if you have what's called a higher error rate, we want you to pay a percentage of the cost. And states can't always control their error rates. And so in this case, how they're going to come up with the money to make up for that, that's anyone's question.
And here we have the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who speaks to make America healthy again, and we're cutting back an essential program that is essential for the health of people. If you don't have enough money for food, nutrition is basic to health, and so it just is almost hypocritical, isn't it?
It's certainly paradoxical that on one hand he is trying to promote healthier eating, and I support him, and many people support him in some of those goals. Some of the things he says are a little wacko, but in general, trying to have people eat healthier. The problem is that in many cases, the things that he's promoting are more expensive. So if you buy more fresh fruit or vegetables, I'm sorry, that may cost more. That may increase your food costs. But if you're taking away SNAP benefits, then poor people have less to spend.
Perfect.
And so you may be encouraging some people to try to be a little healthier in their eating. On the other hand, you're snatching food away from the tables of the poorest households.
Exactly. So what do you tell people about what to do with all of this information? What's your advice to people, your friends, your neighbors, people you come in contact with?
Well, obviously, there are a couple of things. One is some of these changes, you know, still could be averted. There is still the possibility that Congress could see that some of these changes that were made were unfortunate and could change. So that's one possibility. But after that, it becomes trickier. And then it's to the extent that state and local officials can figure out what can we do to blunt the impact of these cuts. And that's not necessarily so easy. In some states, there are ways that they are doing things where they have some supplemental programs. So, for example, New York has the Essential Health Program. It's a basic health program. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like Medicaid and CHIP and providing extra coverage. But even there, you know, so this is an effort that New York has made, though largely still with federal funding. You know, some of the funding for that is being cut back, too.
Yes.
New York has done a variety of things to basically support the notion of trying to make sure that it takes care of indigent people and to provide care. But how New York will pay for these things will be a challenge and will become tougher and tougher because the One Big Beautiful Bill Act is going to take away hundreds of billions of dollars out of state economies.
And while we have a community that really does step up when people are in need, whether it's from a natural disaster or when these cuts in food stamps started to happen last year, the pantries, we're looking at how do we help these food pantries, it's not a sustainable solution to just have volunteer efforts to help people get the food they need. And so we need to pay attention to these cuts and the impact on our friends, our families, and for some people who are listening, on ourselves, you know, if we can't afford to buy healthy foods and we've been on the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Well, if people would like to read the brief that you just wrote, how can they do so?
The simplest thing is you go to the website www.commonwealthfund.org. You'd have to look around through it. Again, this report was issued in early June, mm-hmm. and you gave the title, it begins with HR1 Funding Cuts. And you can find that report, and it's available there.
And you can probably Google Leighton's name. It's L-E-I-G-H-T-O-N, and his last name is K-U. And that is Leighton Koo, and Leighton is the professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management and director of the Center for Health Policy Research at the Milken Institute School of Public Health at George Washington University. Leighton, thank you so much for this work that you're doing and for coming back on to Health Center in the Catskills.